Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 17 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that has a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me as always is my hostess, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
There are just too many idiots in the world right now. And, you know, I'm not specifically saying I want them all dead. I'm just saying the reason that I really enjoy zombie movies is because I can delude myself into thinking that all the dumb people get eaten and the smart people survive.
Oh, Aaron, that is just bad fantasy, because if the smart people survive throughout the whole movie, then it's not a good zombie movie.
Well, yeah, but, you know, the ones who die, you can tell yourself that they were the stupid ones.
Not Night of the Living Dead. That's just a buzzkill, the end of that one. But, oh, such a good movie. And my daughter has gotten to telling people, because she's aware of Night of the Living Dead, and I've told her about it, and I've told her when she's older, she can watch it, but I've also, like, when she was saying that, we do watch some adulter movies, non-children's movies, and like, she loves The Day the Earth Stood Still. Oh, does that make me a proud daddy, that she is absolutely in love with The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Well, I assume you mean the original and not the Keanu Reeves remake.
I haven't watched that, and I'm a grown-ass man. You can't make me. I have heard no good things about it. And again, it's Hollywood keeps remaking good movies. Don't. If the movie was good, don't remake it. Take a movie that has good source material or is a good idea but was poorly executed. Like Lord of the Rings. There was a Lord of the Rings movie, the animated movie from the late 80s, early 90s. It sucked.
Ralph Bakshi
did The Return of the King. There was actually one that was essentially, and it was Two Towers and Return of the King, and then there was The Fellowship of the Ring. It was totally botched, but yeah, there was the Ralph Bakshi one as well, and yet they were lacking, severely lacking. So yeah, when you're going to, you know, remake those, awesome, good work, good on you for that. Same also with The Hobbit, except for fail. Judge Dredd. Oh, did you see the later Carl Urban Dredd movie?
I have not, although I'm told it's pretty good.
It is wonderful. It is wonderful. And again, exactly what Hollywood needs to do. If you're not going to come up with an original idea, take a previous done idea that was poorly executed and go for it.
So what I'm hearing from you is that Hollywood needs to reboot Battlefield Earth.
I think I might have said good source material. I think that was said beforehand.
But look at all the books in the Battlefield Earth series. There's like a dozen or so.
But I am not a member of the Church of Scientology, so I was not forced by L. Ron Hubbard himself to buy them. So I haven't read them, but I have read some of the synopses on Wikipedia, and that sounds like they are as bad as the movie. And I did watch Battlefield Earth, and that was almost so bad it was good. It was so bad it was mediocre.
So my favorite bad movie is Swordfish.
Ooh.
And it's basically John Travolta hamming it up as the bad guy against Storm and Wolverine in a vaguely computer hacker type heist. I don't know. I enjoyed the heck out of it. Everyone else tells me it was terrible. I enjoyed it.
I'll even go and turn around. I have also heard everyone say it's terrible. I don't think it's that bad. Like, it's not like Hackers, which there, if you want to talk about like computer hacking movie that is just hilarious, like Hackers is the computer version of Fast and the Furious. Like, if you know anything about computers, you're like, oh my God, they think they're talking about computers.
Now, is Hackers the one with the young Angelina Jolie?
Yes.
See, I keep confusing Hackers with Sneakers, which Ooh. Is also a computer-based movie.
Yes.
My voice is my passport. Verify me.
That was a good movie. I saw that in the theater. Oh, that was, yeah, Robert Redford. And Ben Kingsley doing an American accent. Stop casting Ben Kingsley as Americans. He can't do an American accent. He's a spectacular actor, but American accents is not a thing he could do. Yeah, no, Sneakers was good. And there's a lot of overlap on that, because there's the whole Whistler character. And they play that Oh, shoot. I forgot the real guy that that's based on. But yeah, there was the guy that was able to have perfect pitch and he could whistle the...
Captain Crunch.
Yeah. Was it actually... It was Captain... Because I know he was Captain... Was he Captain Crunch in Hackers?
No, but the person you're based off of, he was called Captain Crunch because he used a Captain Crunch whistle mm-hmm. to freak the phone lines.
Yes.
For our listeners, that's freak with a PH.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Well, you just weren't fast enough.
No, I was not. I was not. Oh, God. Good, bad movies. But yeah, I've told my, getting back to where I was going, I told my daughter.
We were going somewhere? What?
Yeah, she said, we were reading Captain Underpants, and Captain Underpants makes reference to Night of the Living Dead. And I mentioned to her that I thought that was funny because Night of the Living Dead is one of my favorite movies. And she says, can I watch that movie? And I said, it's a little bit scary. I don't know if you'd like it. And then I just said, you know what? This is a good excuse for me to rewatch Night of the Living Dead. So I rewatched Night of the Living Dead. And while my daughter was asleep, and went, oh, yeah, no, she is not ready for this yet.
What are your thoughts on Fast Zombies, like 28 Days Later?
Well, I hate 28 Days Later, because number one,
you hate it?
Yeah.
Did not
like it at all. My dad bought me a copy of it for Christmas one year, and I tried to drink enough booze to make it good, and that didn't even work.
What? Why? Nope.
Do not like it. Number one, they're not zombies. Number two, they fully explain how it works, is that it's, I think they refer to it as a virus.
Yeah, the rage virus.
Yeah, and good zombie movies, they've got ideas of how it works, but nobody ever really knows exactly how it works. But that being said, actually, besides the original Night of the Living Dead, my second favorite zombie movie of all time is David Fincher. Is it David Fincher? Yeah, David Fincher remake of Dawn of the Dead. Like, that movie's good, and that's Fast Zombies. And some of the best gunplay in a major Hollywood movie, because evidently Fincher's a bit of a shooter.
Oh.
Wait, was that Fincher?
I don't know. Please stand by as we consult
No,
the
it's
Googles.
Zack Snyder. I said David Fincher, I meant Zack Snyder. I get them confused of that year class of ridiculously good directors. But Zack Snyder evidently is a bit of a shooter and does mix some gun stuff into it, into most of his movies. And he was saying he was constantly fighting with the prop houses because they're like, oh, they were trying to throw like Desert Eagles and MP5s at him. And he's like, no. Mall security guards are not going to have Desert Eagles and MP5s. No, they're going to have old beat up Smith & Wesson revolvers, and that's what we're going to use.
Well, I don't know. What about Gecko 45?
Oh, Gecko 45. I believe he was using 10mm, no, 357 SIG Glocks. That was Gecko 45's sidearms. He was had 357 Glocks of all the sizes.
You know, if you're going to have 45 in your name and you're talking about guns, you really should be carrying a 1911, because otherwise it just damages your credibility.
Yeah, I think Tam has hinted on her blog that Gecko 45 was just nothing but a complete and utter troll, and he was just playing games with it, and there were people in the know behind the scenes just laughing their rears off at all the people being played.
You know, that's what I tell myself every time I see something that's just ridiculously stupid. I just invoke Poe's Law and say, it's a troll account. That's what I'm sticking to, because otherwise I'm going to believe that the human race is just irreparably dumb. So, yeah, troll. La 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 la.
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing, because have you seen the latest news story on, like, Sacha Baron Cohen? Yeah.
Yeah, so as we segue into our main topic, yuck.
Yeah, I have a lot of mixed feelings on this, most of which I think is going to align perfectly with you of the yuck. Like, so for those that don't know, so.
And I envy your ignorance.
Yeah. Sacha Baron Cohen, the guy who did Borat and, what was his gay German character?
Bruno.
Bruno and all of those other stuff that, like, I think you and I both agree that we are completely incapable of watching any of that crap.
I just don't like cringe humor in general, because I guess I've got a fair amount of empathy. Cringe humor makes me uncomfortable. I couldn't watch The Office, for crying out loud. It was just not funny. I felt, ugh, I didn't like it. And so that's when people are in on the joke. And then to see somebody go out of their way to ridicule someone else. I mean, it's one thing to try and gotcha someone who is doing something legitimately wrong, illegal, you catch them in a lie. You know, good old-fashioned investigative journalism, okay. But these people aren't doing anything wrong. But it's just, well, Cohen is British, and formerly Great Britain no longer has a spine when it comes to firearms. And he decided he was going to mock and ridicule people who believe in firearm ownership. And so he trolled them and mocked them and humiliated them just for the lulz, just to score political points. And I find that reprehensible. And, hell, there's also the fact that I'm looking at the things he got him to do, and I'm going, how did you not realize you were being trolled? I mean, he mentions, like, the Blink-182 hormone. And okay, even if you don't know that Blink-182 is a band, you know, you might maybe go, that doesn't sound right. But especially when he asks people to film PSAs teaching toddlers how to shoot the bad guys using guns that have little fuzzy characters on them, like, you know, point Mr. Doggy at the bad guy and pull the trigger until he takes a long nap. It's like, come on, really, guys? Really? You couldn't have walked away at that point, realizing you were being set up? And, I don't know, maybe I'm victim blaming, but I'm just intensely paranoid about the sort of thing. It's why I am really nervous every time I go to an interview, because I know these things happen. You know, I was there on the internet when Katie Couric selectively edited her interview of the Virginia Citizens Defense League, and she made them look like idiots. And then someone said, oh no, here's our copy of the interview. You can see how she selectively edited it. And so I don't trust people to give objective interviews. And so this happens with the same guy from the VCDL, and I'm just, wait, what? Oh, God. And there's more of this to follow, because it wasn't just Van Cleef. Apparently, he got a Congress critter to drop his pants and use a racial epithet, and there's more stuff that's apparently coming with Sarah Palin and Dick Cheney and who knows who else. And I know I'm talking over you. I should let you say something now.
Yeah, well, I agree with you on that, especially with the in the even real life shooting world. So Sasha's taking this character. I'm trying to look to see what his name is, and I don't want to hit play on the stupid video again.
He's playing
an IDF colonel or something.
He's playing an Israeli colonel. I don't remember his name. The thing is, if I didn't dislike what he does, he is an amazing mimic. He's got good body language and the accent. And, you know, I admire his artistry. I just wish he wasn't such a douche about it.
Yeah. And he's got some extra makeup on, so he still looks like Sacha Baron Cohen, but he looks different enough that you might go, you know, you kind of look like that dude.
Well, to be fair, he didn't interview people who were very likely to know who Sacha Baron Cohen is.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, number one, if you're in any sort of the gun world, and this goes for, you know, for Philip Van Cleef and they got Larry Pratt was on this video and all that. The people that are in the gun know. The Congress people will step back and see, like, the, okay, are you someone that supports Second Amendment rights, or are you an actual gun nut? Like, do you go out shooting? Do you know these laws, ins and outs and all that? When you get into that, you've always got to keep your eye out just for the the creepy people, the people that are going to be dodgy and are just not the kind of people you want to align yourself with. I'll call out. I mean, we talked about Robert Farrago last week as someone that's just one of those, oh, no, no, don't touch him with a 10-foot pole. That guy is a train wreck waiting to happen. You know, there was James Yeager is another guy of when he started challenging people for duels and having his students stand down range while they were shooting and all that. It's just one of those like, okay, this is not good stuff. This is stuff to avoid. And there's all these like crazy, super tactical ninja trainers out there. And when you start getting that vibe, you know, you kind of go, no, of the, okay, this is the time when we back away slowly. They can smell fear. and so even, you know, even if he didn't quite realize that he was being played, I mean, according to Van Cleave on multiple sources and before any of this came out, he announced what was going on and said he was kind of playing along with it just to see what was going on. I don't know how true that is. And I don't know what played out from this. And again, he mentioned that there's long, long series of what they were doing that slowly worked their way up so they could edit things together and work them out so that the person would get more and more relaxed and more willing to do something silly. And to be fair, I got to say the Philip Van Cleave sections, although the humor is in extremely poor taste, like the delivery is funny. As a matter of fact, Sacha Baron Cohen is kind of not really bringing a whole lot to the table when it comes to the comedy. While Philip Van Cleave, I see a little wink to the camera. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm projecting that, but it's not as cringeworthy as his other stuff. Like my parents found the Ali G show, you know, back, it might've either been just before or just after the Borat movie came out and they were watching Ali G and they're like, oh, this is so funny. Let's sit down and watch this. And I lasted like 5 minutes of it when he's just taken someone that just does not know any better. This is just an average Joe on the street and you are just playing them and taking advantage of the fact that you probably talked to dozens of people and you found the three stupidest people that you could play, with. And you're just making fun of them. And I'm just like, this isn't comedy. This is mean. This is just being mean. And I don't like being mean. That's not how I was raised. That's not what you're supposed to do. And so I haven't liked Sacha Baron Cohen since then, with the exception of his character in Talladega Nights. He was funny in that, but again, he was acting. This was not he was not putting on a scam. Like he was being a legitimate comedic actor. Good on you for that. But this one, it's all these people are all, I would say, would be valid targets. I mean, you see me making fun of people in my audio fisks, and those are all people that are valid targets. I'm not going to go on Facebook and find, you know, so-and-so's anti-gun friend and, you know, call them up and interview them and then be tearing them apart. Because it's one of those, like, who the heck is this person? What are they doing?
Well, I sort of agree with you and I sort of don't. Being active in the political sphere, yes, they are valid targets. What I take exception to is what business is it of his? Because he doesn't live here. I would consider it a more legitimate tactic if this was done by an American who lives under our laws. But this guy, it really seems to me like he is embodying the British belief of, oh, we don't have any guns. We are so superior. Oh, you stupid Yanks. You are so barbaric. You have your guns and we will make fun of you. Ha ha ha. And that just really, really irritates me because I see this double standard and I have just this huge freaking bee in my bonnet about double standards and hypocrisy. Because you see, it's okay for Britain to make fun of Americans. But if Americans make fun of Britons, oh my God, how could they? I mean, it's, and I see this on Facebook a lot. I see countries who have, they aren't affected by us at all. And they think that they can lecture us about our laws. Like, for example, All right, we share a common border with Mexico, and Mexico produces a lot of the drugs that Americans consume. Mexico has a legitimate grievance talking about the drug problem in America. That's fine. That's legitimate. What business is it of any other country who's not affected by this? And so when the French, when the Germans, when the British, when the Australians lecture us about our guns, I'm going, who the hell are you to talk to us about this? You are not affected by this. Mm-hmm. And it really annoys me. But, oh, heaven forbid we should say that, oh, well, you know, we think maybe Germany should maybe contribute more to its own defense against Russia. Oh, how dare you? Ha, 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 ha. And it makes me see red. I start wanting to stab people through the internet.
Once you perfect that, please let me know. Because
oh, you'll know.
Oh, it'll be on every channel.
I mean, when lots of people suddenly drop dead under inexplicable circumstances, but just they were in front of their computer at the time. That was me.
And I wonder, actually, does Baron Cohen, he's got to have a place here. The amount of stuff that he does for Hollywood, he probably has a place here as well, but I don't know where his citizenship stands. But either way, you do have some valid points. But at the same time, I think that we should be able to take all comers. And I guess you could say, you know, what's his ground? But also, what's his point? Like, he's not actually taking apart. This is character assassination is what he's doing here. And so instead of trying to say, oh, Americans, they like their guns and they like the right to keep and bear arms, and here's why it's wrong, you know, of which, you know, we do the counter argument all the time is here's why it's right. They have to do character assassination because I don't know if there is much of a defense to it. So it's also how much ground is going to be made through this. Overall, the people who hate us are going to continue to hate us, and those of us who are aligned with these people are going to be like, yeah, well, that happened. Probably not the smartest move, but at the same time, life goes on.
So let me give you folks some advice if you ever find yourself being interviewed. And I'm not billing myself as an expert at all. I just happen to have been doing this for a couple of years, so I have a bit more experience. And really what it comes down to is if you don't cooperate, they don't have a show. So if you feel that you are being taken advantage of, just stop talking. Don't engage. Leave. I mean, you may have still given them some material, but don't keep going and give them other material. And if I leave you with nothing else, I leave you with this. And this is something that Philip Van Cleve mentioned when he talked about it, and I will give him props for admitting that he had been shanghaied and warning other people. But ever since Katie Couric did that editing, which happened before I started Blazing Sword, I have made it a practice to tell people who are interviewing me, now just so you know, I am recording this interview. It's not that I don't trust you. It's just a practice that I have because, well, Katie Couric did it once and she ruined it for everyone. So I'm going to be recording this conversation. The good news is that means you can record our conversation too instead of having to take notes. And so far, everyone has said, yes, that's fine. No problem. And I talk with them. But if you ever get someone who says, no, I don't want you to record our interview, leave. Leave. Just have nothing to do with that. Because if they don't want you to have a record of it, they are up to something.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I'm firmly on that. And plus, also, you're giving an interview that belongs to you as well. It is both of your properties. So you might as well keep a copy of it for yourself as well. So let's move on to the general purpose egghead. He's going to give us a primer on battery technology.
Welcome back, everyone. This is General Purpose Egghead, and this week we are going to be starting our discussion of batteries. So before we get started, a word of caution. Don't go playing around with batteries or electric circuits until you know what you're doing. I'm going to go over some of the basic terms of round batteries and how they're used, and give some examples as to how batteries are wired together in circuits. But I certainly can't give an adequate explanation of electrical safety in a 10-minute segment. If you accidentally short-circuit or otherwise abuse certain kinds of batteries, they can catch fire or even explode. So before you wire anything together that wasn't designed to run that way, be sure to do your own research. So with that out of the way, let's get started. Batteries can obviously be very useful to your average prepper. Running everything from flashlights and GPS units to red dot optics or even thermal sights. Most batteries that people use are called primary cells, and they are one-time use, and they're less useful for preppers just because it's a finite resource. And eventually, no matter how many of them you stock up, you're going to run out. To that end, the batteries and battery technology we're going to talk about is going to be rechargeable batteries. They offer several advantages over primary cells, but they do require a little bit more advanced understanding. We're also going to cover a lot of the electrical terminology you're going to need to understand how batteries work. Specifically, we're going to talk about voltage, amperage, amp hours, and discharge rate. In this first segment, we are going to cover some of the basics of that battery terminology, and in the next segment, we're going to talk about different types of rechargeable batteries and how to use them and charge them. So to start with, let's talk about some basic electrical terms. A useful metaphor for picturing in your head how electricity works is water flow. So as we go through these terms, I'm going to relate them to how water behaves to help you picture it. So the first term is voltage. You've probably heard it before. So what is voltage? It is electrical potential, and in the water analogy, you can think of it like water pressure. All else being equal, more pressure means more water or more electricity is going to flow through a given line. So higher voltage is going to drive more current. And current is measured in amperes or amps. And amps are how much electricity is traveling through a wire over a length of time. It's like measuring how much water is coming out of a garden hose in gallons per minute. The third component involved is resistance, which is measured in ohms. And that measures how difficult it is to push electricity through the circuit. These three terms, voltage, amperage, and resistance, are the three primary words we use to describe how electricity flows. And then we have a couple of terms that are derived from those. One that's very useful when talking about batteries is amp hours. An amp hour is the amount of charge you get when you have 1 amp of current for 1 hour. So if amperage is gallons per minute through a garden hose, an amp hour is how much water you get after a minute, which is to say a gallon. So an amp hour is a quantity used to measure how much charge you have in something like a battery. Now an amp is actually quite a bit of current, and an amp hour is quite a bit of charge. So most measurements you're going to hear are going to be in milliamps and milliamp hours, and that's 1/1000th of an amp or 1/1000th of an amp hour. So now we have all the terms we need to describe how a battery will perform. A battery has a voltage, which is like water pressure, and a capacity, which is like gallons of water that it holds. So I can use these to figure out how large of a battery I need to run a given electronic device for a certain amount of time. So to make our first example easy, let's just say everything is running on 12 volts. This is about the voltage of a standard car battery and is very commonly used for portable electronics. Say I have a 12-volt radio that uses 1 amp of current, and I want to be able to run it for a complete 24 hours. If you take a battery's capacity in amp hours divided by the amount of current in amps, that'll give you how many hours it'll last. So to run a 1 amp device for 24 hours, I would need 24 amp hours of capacity. But what if everything isn't at the same voltage? What if I have a 12-volt device that wants to be plugged into a car, but I don't have a 12-volt battery? Well, then I can take lower voltage batteries and wire them in series and add their voltages together. And to wire batteries in series means you take the positive end of one battery and put it to the negative end of another battery. And then the two of those together form a battery that has twice the voltage and the same amount of capacity. This is exactly what's happening when you stack two batteries on top of each other in your tactical flashlight. The flashlight wants to run on 6 volts, but each individual battery only provides 3. So they build the battery compartment so you stack two batteries on top of each other, giving you 6 volts that the flashlight needs. So, in theory, if I needed to power a 12-volt device and all I had was those little 3-volt lithium batteries for my tactical flashlight, I could stack 4 of them on top of each other and then plug that in, and that would power my device. In the real world, they'd probably burn out very quickly because they don't have a lot of capacity relative to your usual 12-volt battery, but you could run it for a little while. The other way to wire up multiple batteries is to wire them in parallel. When you wire batteries in parallel, you connect the positive terminal of each battery to the positive terminal of the other batteries. Where in series you're stacking batteries on top of each other like AA batteries in a tube, in parallel you're stacking them side by side. When you wire batteries in parallel, they give the same voltage, but you get double the capacity. Because if I put 2 batteries side by side, each battery is only providing half the current to the total circuit. Any kind of power storage system is probably going to involve batteries both wired in parallel and in series. So in theory, if I stack 2 batteries side by side in parallel, I will get twice the battery life out of a device as I would with just 1 battery. In reality, though, you'll probably get a little bit more than that. And the reason why has to do with discharge rate. And discharge rate is how fast you're discharging a battery relative to its total capacity. You can calculate your discharge rate by dividing the number of amps of current you're pulling from your battery by the capacity in amp hours. And the abbreviation for discharge rate is C. So if I am drawing 10 amps from a 1 amp hour battery, I am discharging it at a rate of 10C. In the real world, most batteries don't like high discharge rates, and you won't get the full rated capacity from them. They're going to die way sooner than they would with a much lower discharge rate. Certain kinds of batteries are more sensitive to this than others, but we'll go over that later when we talk about different kinds of rechargeable batteries. Just be aware that trying to draw a lot of power out of a small battery is going to cause it to die much faster than it would otherwise. So, to recap, batteries are rated with a voltage, in volts of course, and a capacity in amp hours. The capacity in amp hours divided by the current in amps is how long the battery will last until it dies. And if you discharge it much faster than the discharge rate measured in C, your battery won't last as long as the capacity would suggest. That's it for this week, and next week we're going to talk about different kinds of rechargeable batteries and what they're going to be useful for.
So I had no idea on all of these things on how the batteries stack up inside the device. My eyes got opened by that. That was like so cool. I'd known about from physics about voltage and amps and currents and ohms and those sort of things. I wasn't very good at them, so my understanding is very limited, but I hadn't quite realized about the wiring them up in series versus wiring up in parallel.
Do you know why they are called batteries?
I don't. All right. You've got my interest, Aaron.
Okay. Because what we call a battery, like a C, D, double A, they're actually comprised of multiple cells. And so we are going by the definition of battery, which means a collection, an array. And so a power battery is actually a collection, a battery of power cells.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. And of course, you've got to have piles of batteries being the blue collar prepper that you are.
I have a good amount, and I have invested heavily in rechargeables. If for no other reason than this, rechargeable batteries do not leak and damage your equipment. I've lost track of how many pieces of equipment my parents have ruined, usually flashlights, by putting batteries in them and then just leaving them. And then years later, they try to use them. Why isn't this working? Well, it's because the battery leaked acid, and now the entire thing is just a fused mass inside the flashlight. You might as well throw it away. Rechargeables don't leak. If for no other reason, that's why you should invest in them.
Though I've got to say, and maybe the Egghead can do this in a future segment, I would love to know about the shelf life of batteries, because I know I had a cell phone a while back that had a replaceable battery, and I went on Amazon, the battery started going low, and I went on Amazon and I found like a replacement battery for it for like $3 with like Prime shipping. It was something ridiculous that I'm like, oh, that can't be a legit battery. Like that is too cheap to be a legit battery. And I went, it's $3 with free shipping. You know what? It's cheap enough that I'm going to give it a try. And it turned out to be a great battery. And I went, oh God, I don't want this guy to go away. So I bought like a bunch of cheap batteries. And so every time my battery started getting even like moderately loss of charge, I just be like, oh, cool, recycle this one. And in goes the new one. Oh, fresh as a daisy. And then like come towards the end of that stash, it was one of those like, oh, this one's worse than the one that was in my phone. It's they eventually start to die on their own. They have a shelf life. And so that's one of those things of the, oh, I'd love to just have just a huge collection of batteries. But at the same time, like, I'd hate to like go reaching for the batteries in a time of need and go, oh yeah, no. These ones went bad like a long, long time ago.
Well, according to Chaplain Tim, who is my go-to guy for a lot of things in blue-collar prepping, and he's got a degree in chemistry, he says that most brands these days have a 5 to 10 year shelf life.
Cool.
It's good to have both kinds of batteries because alkaline batteries give you a lot more power quickly, as opposed to some types of rechargeables, which I'm using the wrong term here, but there's a bit of a lag between pressing the power button and then building up. Also, a lot of rechargeables just don't have the juice to operate some types of equipment. You know, flashlights are probably good, but when you start getting into things like, I'm drawing a blank here, but you know, I would say something like the equivalent of a Walkman. I mean, I know everyone uses iPods these days, but bear with me here. Something like that, it draws too much power immediately, and you need like the high voltage, the high performance rechargeables rather than sort of the bargain basement rechargeables. Then there's the fact that rechargeable batteries do slowly lose their charge over time, and they do lose them faster than an alkaline does. So it's good to have both.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. Hey, so speaking of batteries, and this is going to be a reach, but guns go into battery, right? Right. Okay. So, Weird, who won our raffle drawing for the 9mm AR lower?
Oh, yeah. That we had the drawing. We mentioned last week that the winner had already been chosen, but we didn't know because we record this ahead of time and then the show gets edited together. So, the winner was, you may know him as Matt in the Facebook group, but others who are listening to podcasts would know him as Heinrich from Geeks, Gadgets, and Guns, and also the LFD Research. So he won, and congratulations to him. He was also one of our early patrons, so he got the double ticket to get better odds at the win. So congratulations to you, Heinrich. You're a good guy to get it, and He's a bit of an engineer. He does firearms design work, and he's got a YouTube channel. So I hope to see a lot more of the guns. As a matter of fact, he was just talking to me on Facebook and saying, so what's more illegal in Massachusetts? What would Maura Healey hate more, if it was an SBR or if it was a pistol with a brace? And I mentioned that SBRs are legal in Massachusetts. AR style pistols are completely not legal in Massachusetts whatsoever. So he goes, pistol with a brace it is. So I look forward to seeing what this gun gets built into. Oh, I'll also let people know, I'm just going to tease it right now. I'll be announcing it at a later time, but I've got another giveaway planned, and I'm kind of excited about it. It's not going to be something as extravagant as a gun, but there's going to be multiple items that I'm going to give away, so more people are going to win on this next raffle.
Ooh.
So if you're listening to this now and you're not a member of our Patreon group, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast and sign up.
So last week, Weird, you started to disprove the Brady segment on bad apple gun dealers. And as the saying goes, it takes more effort to disprove a lie than it takes to make it. So what do we get in Bad Apple Dealers Part 2?
Well, you're going to get them talking a lot more about what bad apple dealers are and their quote-unquote solutions, so let's have a listen. So last week, I started to tackle a Brady campaign video covering what has become a common talking point of the corporate anti-gun lobby. Bad apple gun dealers. It took almost the entirety of the last segment for us to get exactly what bad apple gun dealers are. But according to the Brady campaign, they are gun shops that have a disproportionate number of their guns recovered at crime scenes. While they imply that this is because of illegal or flippant behavior, if that was true, the Brady campaign would have nothing to do with this, and these deals would be shut down and possibly jailed by the ATF for violating federal laws. In fact, bad apple gun dealers are simply dealers who operate in high-crime urban areas where guns are frequently stolen or illegally traded. Really, the Brady campaign is simply looking to shut down gun dealers any way they can.
So, what are we doing, and why does it work?
I'd love to hear what you're doing, and I'm curious on what metrics you use to deem these tactics as a success.
First, we identify the bad apple gun dealers supplying guns to a given city. Some of those dealers will be local, others won't be.
Most of them will be local, except in places like San Francisco or Chicago, where anti-gun city legislators push the gun shops outside the city limits. Again, this is all a factor of urban crime. If it wasn't, we would be talking federal felonies, as we already have plenty of laws to combat this.
Local police have data identifying the bad apple dealers, but many of them have never analyzed it that way.
Mostly because this is not evidence of a crime being committed. And likely, if there were crimes being committed, like say a dealer knowingly selling to a straw buyer or selling guns off the books without background checks, that's a federal crime and not something that the local law enforcement can do anything about.
We're leading a coalition that's already working with the Oakland Police Department to analyze its data. And we have similar efforts underway in Los Angeles and in Stockton, as well as in cities outside of California.
All those high crime cities in the number one ranked Brady campaign state that has every bit of gun control you could think of. It's almost like gun control doesn't work.
Then once we know who they are, we partner with community organizations and stakeholders to develop customized strategies for each one to either get them to reform or to shut them down.
Yeah, about those community organizers.
He's the owner of Chuck's. John Riggio, R-I-G-G-I-O. We're going to find you and snuff you out. You can't keep hiding because you're afraid. Obviously, you know you're doing something wrong.
That's Father Michael Flager of Chicago at a Brady campaign-sponsored rally against an alleged bad apple gun dealer. And it appears that Father Flager, like any good man of the cloth, is calling for the murder of that gun store owner. Isn't that wonderful?
These customized strategies leverage a variety of tactics. For example, we have a long history of bringing lawsuits against bad apple gun dealers. We've been doing that for 20 plus years.
And these tactics are again directed in simply shutting down lawful gun dealers.
One of the cases that we settled this summer involved a gun dealer called Lock and Load. And as part of the settlement, the store owner agreed to never again be in the business of selling firearms.
So go check the show notes. I have a link to the press release from the Brady campaign just announcing that the lawsuit had gone into discovery, but no further information. I found a local news story about the case, and I found some interesting facts. The case revolves around a violent, mentally ill man who entered Lock and Load and was denied a sale because he flunked the background check. At a later date, a neighbor was enlisted to conduct a straw buy and bought the man a shotgun that he later used to murder his mother and her boyfriend while they slept. So the article notes that the lawsuit was settled. The Brady campaign has a long history of lawsuits, but to my knowledge, I don't think they've ever won a single case. Their cases are always to harass and intimidate, not to win. Also, in this article, there was no mention of any criminal charges against the owner of the gun shop, nor against the man who illegally transferred the shotgun to a prohibited person. Oh, and Lock and Load was sold as part of the settlement, but it's still a gun shop, and you can still buy guns there.
We team up with local leaders to educate the community on both the criminal and economic effects that stem from the activities of these bad apple gun dealers.
Which sounds nice, but note when Brady actually does that, it looks more like a lynch mob than a course in a community college.
He's the owner of Chuck's. John Riggio, R-I-G-G-I-O. We're going to find you and snuff you out. You can't keep hiding because you're afraid. Obviously, you know you're doing something wrong.
We have specific tactics that work on mom and pop bad apples, on publicly traded bad apples, on bad apples that double as sporting goods stores. And right now, we're focused on implementing comprehensive, multifaceted, five-year programs in six cities, including Oakland and Los Angeles.
For the mom and pops, they file frivolous lawsuits that bankrupts them with legal fees and lost business. With publicly traded gun businesses, they try and tank the stock price to drive them out of business. And for sporting good chains, they attempt to convince them that the anti-gun side is the smart side. And look at how well that's worked out for Dick's Sporting Goods. If they hold a 0-1 FFL, they want it shut down.
The lessons learned from these six cities will be scaled to other cities around the nation. We hope that you'll help us get it off the ground by supporting this innovative, data-driven, and strategic approach to reducing the supply of crime guns.
Give them money, because those gun shops won't close themselves. Note that while they plan a nationwide rollout, they are starting in California, the number one Brady-ranked state with a horrible violent crime problem. One of the shiny examples of why gun control doesn't work, and how none of these policies, laws, or practices will translate to individual safety. Nope, their plan is always shutting down gun shops and banning guns. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
So let me see if I've got this straight. What the Brady campaign calls bad apple dealers are actually gun dealers who sell in high crime neighborhoods where people may have their guns stolen, and their idea of fighting this crime, quote unquote, is to drive legitimate merchants out of business. Did I miss anything?
Nope, that's pretty much it. That's their whole point, is they're perfectly fine with the guy selling guns out of the trunk of their car. They want to get rid of the shops that sell guns to people with background checks.
Now, isn't the Brady campaign the same campaign that encouraged a grieving family to sue Lucky Gunner because they sold some jerk the ammunition he used to shoot up? Was it the theater in Colorado?
You're thinking of the Phillips family. And yes, the Brady didn't just encourage it. The Brady campaign enabled it. They made it happen. They facilitated it. I mean, they supplied the lawyer, probably a pro bono lawyer. They did all of the work, and the Phillips were just there as the complainants. And they even hired them on as Brady staffers. So what happened is, of course, this was all in really flagrant disregard to the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which was actually started by the Brady campaign when they were throwing frivolous lawsuits at gun dealers and gun manufacturers. Again, as I said in the post, they file a whole lot of lawsuits. I don't think they've ever won a case, but that was never the point. Is they would throw the lawsuit at it so that they would have to pony up money to start defending it. And while the Brady campaign would start with a pro bono lawyer, you know, if you're Bushmaster Firearms or some other group like that that's been sued, your lawyer's not doing pro bono. They're taking cash. And so you've got to do all the filings. You've got to do all the defense. You've got to do all the discovery. That costs a lot of money. And so even if you win, you lose.
The process is the punishment.
The process is the punishment. So very much on the same line as that, when the Phillips filed their lawsuit against, it was Lucky Gunner, our friends at Lucky Gunner. They are not a sponsor, but we welcome them back whenever they want to. They're a great company, really a wonderful company.
Anthony, if you want me to do a promo every week like I did for Gunblog Variety Cast, I'm totally down for that.
So when they sued Lucky Gunner, it was such a frivolous lawsuit that it never even really went to court. Like, in the preliminary hearing, the judge went, yep, nope, this is a violation of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. I dismiss it. There was no win-lose. It was just there is no case. Oh, and you, for bringing forth this case that was illegal to bring forth, you had to pay the lawyer fees for Lucky Gunner.
Yeah, hang on. So first of all, I believe it wasn't just dismissed. I believe it was dismissed with prejudice.
I don't actually know the legal definition of that term, so...
Well, I am not a lawyer either, but I believe the definition roughly is, if it's dismissed with prejudice, it's one of those, and don't come back. This is so baseless that I will not entertain any further nonsense. Just go away, don't come back, I don't want to see you again. Plus, the Brady campaign was left on the hook for the lawyer fees, and they immediately stuck the Phillips family with them.
Yeah, well, I mean, so technically speaking, so the way we see it, and the really the just way, in my opinion, is the Brady campaign was left on the hook for, I believe, something to the tune of about $250,000. Because the Brady campaign was essentially the people behind the lawsuit. The Phillips were the complainants. They were the ones there. But really, it was the Brady campaign that set everything up. This was their lawsuit. Yet as soon as the ruling came that they have to pay up, the Brady campaign disappeared. They were like, oh, no, we're not part of this. And the Phillips had to declare bankruptcy. And I believe at this time, they might not be anymore, but at the time of their declaring bankruptcy, they were living out of a motorhome. They had sold their house and were living out of an RV. And the RV was their primary residence, which can't be seized as part of a bankruptcy filing. But they've essentially lost everything. And I remember seeing some of their interviews that they did for the news programs, like right when this lawsuit was starting to go forward. And they lived a pretty decent life. So
let's just hammer this home. The Brady campaign, who claimed to be bastions of morality, capitalized on a grieving family, used them as a figurehead for a frivolous lawsuit, and when that lawsuit failed, they left this grieving family on the hook for all the charges, resulting in their bankruptcy.
That is correct.
I still don't understand why people listen to them.
They really don't. And I only think the reason why you were hearing that audio is I have a deep suspicion that Michael Bloomberg has started paying the Brady's bills. They've started getting a lot closer to the Bloomberg organizations. They were really kind of antagonist organizations, because the Brady campaign used to be the group that had all the celebrities, and it was the Mayors Against Illegal Guns. It was all the anti-gun politicians. And so they had their own glad handing thing, is the, all right, you handle people in this circle, we handle people in that circle. And then Bloomberg started taking up all the celebrity activist groups and just left Brady high and dry. And meanwhile, also Bloomberg just cast such a big shadow that there aren't that many people. When you look at, say, like the NRA, the most of the money from the NRA is just small donations, you know, $20, $100 or less, I believe, is the bulk of NRA's money, besides their dues fees, is donations of $100 or less. But meanwhile, when you look at groups like Mayors Against Illegal Guns, the Brady campaign and all that, they have small numbers of very, very high dollar donors. And so when you've got such few people to pull from, they could be persuaded to spend their money wiser. And Bloomberg was deemed as the stronger candidate that was doing the exact same thing. And so the Brady campaign suffered greatly, and they really were kind of anti-Bloomberg for a while. And now all of a sudden they were being a lot more friendly. And I kind of wonder if Bloomberg might have bought them out, because that would be beneficial to him, because his name is absolute poison. Hence the reason why his name's not on anything that he owns anymore when it comes to gun control. So we'll have to see.
We've talked in the past about how so many political organizations play the if you like X, then you must also support Y game. In this episode of Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, David notes that people, including gun people, are guilty of this as well.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. Associations are funny things. You can be associated with people you've never met, or ideas that have no bearing on your life, or are even diametrically opposed to the ideas you actually hold. As someone with strong feelings about firearms freedom, especially in a place as unfriendly as New York to these ideas, this happens with alarming regularity. This type of forced association occurs in almost every conversation I have with my mother where the subject of guns come up. In my last conversation with my mother, she stated I had too many guns. Mom didn't quite know how to respond when I instantly came back with, "There's no such thing." When I was young, my mother actually tried to blame World War II on, quote, people like you, unquote, meaning people with my interest in firearms. If I had a dollar for every time it was suggested I held a certain political position simply because of my respect for the Second Amendment, I'd be well on my way to that museum of all firearms ever made I mentioned in my last segment. For example, in addition to American Rifleman, I've had subscriptions to Guns and Ammo, Shooting Times, Gun Tests, and a few other related magazines. Apparently, some marketing algorithm decided that since I liked guns, I'd also be interested in mailings from cigar distributors, whiskey distilleries, and anti-abortion, or if you prefer, pro-life, organizations. I don't smoke, but I do like pancakes. I don't drink, and while I'm conflicted in the case of abortion, I don't think it's the government's job to make that decision for anyone, pro or con. Needless to say, those mailings did not get a positive response. Since the Second Amendment is my litmus test for favor, the same is often true with politicians. If I mention that I like a certain politician's record on gun ownership, I must therefore support all their other positions. Politically, I generally lean small l libertarian, or as I like to put it, I'm a member in good standing of the Leave Me the Hell Alone party. This reminds me of another example. Years ago, I was hanging out with some friends in college, and one of them asked me about my personal politics. I answered with something like, I'm not really sure, but I've been told I'm probably closest to libertarian. He came back with that I must then be against child labor laws. When I expressed confusion, he said that I claim to be a libertarian, and libertarians don't support child labor laws. This told me two things about this person. One, they hadn't listened to what I'd actually said, and two, they were more interested in playing a game of gotcha than in having a rational discussion. Before we moved out of New York, I was involved with cowboy action shooting. I may start that up again in our new home, but that's for another time. For those who aren't familiar with it, cowboy action shooting is a competition involving lever-action rifles, single-action revolvers, and double-barrel or early-pump shotguns at relatively close-range steel targets. All of this while dressed in historical period or Hollywood cowboy-style clothing. It's lots of fun. This was around the same time as the passage of the New York State Mirror of the Federal Assault Weapons Ban, so around the year 2000. I was at an event and was chatting with some of the shooters. Now, you would expect that folks participating in a shooting event would be generally pro-gun. Nope. Their big concern was that the law didn't affect their firearms and sport. They assumed that since I was there, that I must feel the same way. Imagine their shock when I stated my opposition to this law and many of the other gun laws that were already on the books. It was a few years before I felt comfortable enough to go back. Since the New York Safe Act in 2013 and the 2016 presidential election, the false associations, or forced associations, people have applied to gun owners have gotten worse. If it turns out some pro-gun political candidate I commented on approvingly has ties to the Ku Klux Klan, I get, David, are you in the Klan? Probably not a lot of Jews in the KKK. Some elected official makes a negative remark about a member of the LGBT community, possibly not even having anything to do with their sexuality, I get, David, are you a homophobe? If so, I'm really bad at it since I was one of the early volunteer instructors with Operation Blazing Sword. If I mention I find almost any comedian these days funny, I get, David, how can you support such misogyny? Why don't you ask any of my many female friends how I treat women? I know I should be patient and calm with these accusations, but it gets harder and harder every year. One day, if I live long enough, I expect to become one of those cranky old men who will tell you exactly what they think in no uncertain terms. I'm kind of looking forward to that. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
So, some of you are probably wondering why David said he doesn't smoke, but he likes pancakes. This is a reference to the schmokin' a pancake scene from the third Austin Powers movie, and it's just easier to play the clip than to explain it.
Would you like a schmokin' a pancake?
A what?
A schmokin' a pancake. You know, flapjack and a cigarette? All right. Cigar and a waffle? No. Pipe and a crepe? No. Bong and a blintz?
No.
Oh, well, then there is no pleasing you.
So the reason he's saying that is David helps me moderate the Operation Blazing Sword Facebook page, and this clip has become both a running joke between us and a shorthand for when we encounter someone who is just determined to be mad and can't be made happy no matter what we do. There is no pleasing you. And in that case, the short phrase, schmoking a pancake, indicates, yeah, we're just going to stop trying. Don't engage with this person any further.
Aaron, have you found yourself similarly pigeonholed by people? The, oh, because you're a gun nut, or, oh, because you're trans, or all that. There's just, I
haven't really been pigeonholed by gun owners, but I have gotten so much flack from the queer community. You know, how dare I support guns because they are used to kill, and gun laws are voted for by Republicans, and the Republicans hate queer people. And I'm just going, look, the Second Amendment is neither a left nor a right agenda. People think that it is, but it's not. And yeah, a lot of times I just offer them a schmoke and a pancake because I can't explain it to their satisfaction.
Well, this got me thinking about on my wife's side of the family. My side of the family is kind of mixed, and it's mixed in a similar way. But my wife's side of the family, their majority of them are from Vermont. They're almost all of them are from either Vermont or Massachusetts, which means they skew very liberal overall. And suddenly in comes me, and they're like, "Oh, you disagree with us. You're like this other relative." And this other relative is a wonderful guy, but he is a, you know, hardcore Republican. And it's one of those like, all right, we get along because we're both the people rolling our eyes at just the air in the room. But at the same time, we agree with about the same number of things on that. Cause I'm like David, I'm a little bit more libertarian leaning. And again, I have to say libertarian leaning because, you know, he mentioned the child labor laws line. And again, it's one of those like, there isn't a libertarian platform. So saying that I'm libertarian-ish always needs to be like stated in paragraph form. And then especially when you've got like also libertarian groups, I'm so close to Keene, New Hampshire, where we've got the Free State Project. And there's people in there that are straight up like, oh, libertarians don't vote. We're anarchists. And I'm like, that's a contradictory term. We've already got a political group that's anarchists. They're called anarchists. If you want to be an anarchist, be that. Don't be an anarchist and call yourself a libertarian, because that's a different thing.
So, yeah, you mentioned the Libertarian Party not really having a platform. And I've got to delve into ponies for just a second here, because I am a fan of a Facebook page called First Awesome Platoon, which generally is military humor done with ponies in the My Little Pony style. But they did a cartoon. It really wasn't about the Libertarian Party, but the final panel encapsulated it so perfectly that I cut out that panel. The only thing I did was I added a subtitle saying "The Libertarian Party of America summarized in a single image." I have posted this. I have posted this to people running under the Libertarian Party banner. They laugh hysterically because they agree that it's true. And I'll do my best to describe it, even though I realize I'm ruining the joke. There'll be a link in the show notes. The cartoon looks like this. You've got your typical stoner on the left side with a bag of marijuana on its hoof. On the right side, you've got your standard pro-gun nut with the Gadsden flag and the tricorn and the AR-15. And they're facing each other and they've got the eyes going in opposite directions indicating craziness. And the only caption there is unintelligible screaming. I know it's horrible, but it's just when you look at the image and it's just on the one side, marijuana, and on the other side, guns, and all they're doing is screeching incoherently. That's the Libertarian Party on a national level, unfortunately.
Yeah. And then, of course, yeah, there's all the different flavors of libertarians. Like if you've got like a hardcore conservative Republican, but they don't necessarily believe that the gays should be stoned to death in the public square, then they consider they're libertarian. or you've got the hardcore, progressive Democrat, but they really think that you should leave guns alone. They're a libertarian.
Well, you know the definition of a libertarian, right? Someone who is too liberal for Republicans and too conservative for Democrats.
Yeah, that's kind of true. That's really where it comes from. Because, I mean, I was raised in a liberal household, and so I identified as a Democrat as a child and voted for Al Gore in my first election because that's what I was supposed to do. Really didn't have any convictions one way or the other towards George W. Bush or Al Gore. Don't really care too much about either one of them.
Wait, the 2000 election was your first election?
That was my first election.
Oh my God, you're young.
It was my first presidential election. I'd voted in like some local and town ones. I was also not like the standard, 18 to 24 demographic where they're a voting block, and they're a voting block that as a general rule doesn't vote. Oh no. Like I was voting for dog catcher. Like the moment I turned 18, it was one of those like, I'm going to go buy tobacco and pornography and go vote because that's what it says I could do.
I just keep forgetting that you're younger than I am, and I didn't realize you were, like, close to a decade younger.
Yeah. You kids today! I have the same experience with Ryan Machado on Handgun Radio as he is exactly 10 years younger than me, and it's just so hilarious. So do you remember that? Oh, no, you don't remember that. Or I used to go drinking there before they shut it down. Yeah, I wasn't legal drinking age when they shut that down. Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't know how much of a nerd gamer you are, but I just discovered this little factoid this week, and it made me feel ancient and cobwebby. The collectible card game Magic the Gathering is 25 years old.
Oh, man, that sounds about right. Oh, boy.
It premiered in Gen Con in 1993.
Speaking of things that I spent way more money on than cigarettes and regret more than cigarettes. Oh, was I addicted to that game. Like, in a horrible, horrible way. Like a behind the music sort of way. Transitioning over to what sounds like an amazing Grindhouse movie, The House Dick brings us the story he promised last week that he calls Motorcycle Assassins.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the rainy day episode of Tales from the Trunk on Motorcycle Assassins. Now, before I get too deep into the weeds with this one also revolved around the concept of, like last week's episode, the Alive and Well check. The nice thing was, is it was relatively local to me, and I figured when it first came across my desk several years back, it'd be pretty easy. It was what you call a dependency check. Now, I'd done a few of them over the years. Basically, if someone is entitled to benefits after the passing of a primary policyholder, this one happened to be related to what we all fondly call the global war on terror. My job was to meet with the minor child and his caregiver, who was his older sister of legal age for guardianship. And my job was to basically ensure that he was still alive and receiving his monthly stipend, was being cared for, wasn't being kept in a cage, and all that fun stuff. So I got the assignment. I double-checked the address and then immediately realized where it was at. It was in one of the rougher projects. Of course, it was well known for drugs, prostitution, violence, murder, homicide and mayhem, and just the assortment of less than wholesome activities that you'd want for a young preteen male. So I spent about a week or two trying to make contact, first via telephone, and then with visits to the address, leaving a calling card and talking to neighbors who were willing to talk without so much as any luck. On a lark, after finishing up work on another case nearby, I decided to make a cold call to the address. What I found was, well, to be perfectly blunt, shocking. I found the youth's caregiver, his older sister, strung out, coming off of what must have been a massive bender as well, and probably 2 or 3 weeks in lockup, complete with that fancy ankle jewelry. Gotta love those GPS tethers. Now, she was only partly lucid, but I did manage to get another address because I asked about her little brother. She managed to croak out something about another home on the other side of town, and her final words to me as she was unceremoniously shoving me out the door is, "He's not my problem. I have enough problems of my own." I later come to learn in subsequent visits, in a year or two's time, that she was a recovering addict who was squandering her own beneficiary payments on drugs and God knows what else. Last time I met with her, she had been clean for about 6 months, and she had become far more presentable and less like a shell of a human. Turns out, she had lost custody of her brother due to her misbehavior and constant encounters with the law, and he actually became a ward of the state and was in foster care with a kind and understanding family that had a few other foster children of their own. No, I made contact with the actual current legal guardians at the time of the beneficiary, and I spent very little actual time speaking to the kid at that point. He wasn't even driving a car yet. But the foster parents did shed some serious light onto what exactly I had walked into. The family were Iraqi by birth, having moved here, I believe, after Gulf War I and the Iran-Iraq Civil War immediately prior to that. Their mother, the deceased, had worked, if I'm not mistaken, as a physician with, I believe, Doctors Without Borders or some other NGO. I don't ever recall there being talk about a father being in the picture, but he was likely conscripted and lost in the conflict that is the Gulf War 2.0. The story goes, according to the foster parent and a briefly referenced incident report provided back by the U.S. military that responded, was that she was riding in a convoy somewhere in the conflict zone when her transport vehicle was attacked. She was with five or six other individuals. The vehicle was attacked by small arms fire, and then her vehicle, which was, I believe, in the middle of the pack, was specifically targeted, for whatever reason, by motorcycle-riding jihadists. They threw in a hand grenade, more small arms fire, and then they fled the scene. We all know how this sort of thing winds up. She died going to save other people's lives. This is perhaps the most brutal story or case that I've ever run into in my 18 years now, 20 years now in the field, aside from, you know, the standard homicide post-insurance investigation and stuff like that. But luckily, the deceased was very well insured, had a considerable amount of savings, and both her son and her daughter would have their needs well covered, including college, upon reaching adulthood, provided that they were responsible. The daughter's behavior was, rightly or wrongly, her coping mechanism for the loss of her only parent. She had only recently become an adult herself when she was thrust into the role of guardian. Last I knew, both were doing okay. The older sister had managed to clean up her act, got a steady job, was going to school, and the young man had graduated high school, and I believe he was bound to enlist and serve in our military. So, the world is a crazy place, friends. Stories like this let me realize how lucky I really do have it, and how safe I really am, even in the crazy places that I work in and around Detroit. So, be safe out there, guys. Be smart. Be kind to your neighbors, and stay out of trouble. Have a good one.
I was kind of expecting you to be the private investigator versus the gang of motorcycle assassins. It was a little bit more of a melancholy story than that. But when he was talking about the fact that it was Middle East motorcycle assassins, I'm like, you know what? That's actually kind of common. Do you remember the assassinations of the Iranian nuclear scientists that was happening back in the early 2000s?
Vaguely.
Yeah, that was when Iran was starting their whole, like, nuclear business that we're still talking about today. And yeah, a whole bunch of them would be riding home from their lab job to their house and in the rush hour, you know, Tehran traffic, and somebody on a motorcycle would speed up behind them and essentially stick a limpet mine to their car and then speed off, and then the car would blow up. So yeah, motorcycle assassins. It's, you know, it's a lot more common than you might think.
Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/AssortedCalibersPodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels.
We just put out that new blooper reel. I hope our patrons are enjoying it, because, man, I laugh my head off when I'm recording them, because it's all the stuff that I've just kind of collected into a bin. And I do it once a month, so some of the stuff's like a month old, so I've forgotten even what we were talking about on that. And so it's kind of fresh again, and I'm just like, oh man, we are having fun.
At this point, we're just playing to the camera, quote-unquote. You know, before we were actually trying to be serious and have a podcast, and then we'd screw up and whatever, and then when we started doing the blooper reels, we just realized, nah, this stuff is gold, so we would just start recording when we start talking, and there are times when I deliberately just do stuff that I know is going to be on a blooper reel, because why not?
I get a bit that doesn't fit in the podcast, but I know where it goes.
So, Weird, where can listeners get more from you?
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And you can hear me every week on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can read more from me at my nerd blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com, and my emergency preparedness blog, which I tend to curate more than write for these days, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our wonderful music.
I like fast zombie movies, and he hates 28 Days Later. Our tastes are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.